Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Trevor Hawkins and Stella Reed from the Southwest Care Center about hepatitis C. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Peter McBride. His book is called The Colorado River Flowing Through Conflict. He's the photographer on that book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this is a fascinating and beautiful book about the Colorado River, which is a very long and very important river. And you go from one end to the other, both in text and in photographs in this book. Why is the Colorado River so important?
Mary Charlotte, the Colorado's not only a beautiful river, it's important because we love it. It's one of these unique, spectacular rivers in the West. It's not the largest or the longest, but it's one of the most loved and litigated. And it's important for, it's basically the lifeline of the Southwest. It supplies water for 7 states and also part of Mexico. And what's making it so important today, particularly, is that it's been in a 10-year drought. We had a little spike in water this last year, but everyone's realizing that we're facing potentially a greater impending drought with climate change, and water is becoming an ever more, you know, serious issue across the West.
The Colorado River is kind of the poster child for over-allocating a water source.
It is. It's over-allocated in part because there's the Colorado Compact is the law of the river, and it was written in 1922, and they actually did a good job in 1922, the architects of the law, considering what data they had available. But the data they had available is not nearly as accurate as the data we have today. And what they thought the river flowed at back in 1922, we've since learned that the river flows at about 3/4 of that flow. And so, in part, that foundation of the law for the river is faulty. So they made a mistake. But that law of the river, at the same time, is still very important. And I think we need to deal with these over-allocations. And right now, the river actually doesn't reach the sea. It stopped reaching the sea in the late 90s.
And which is amazing. You've got pictures in the book of this once river delta, now just dried up mud.
It's remarkable. I partnered with John Waterman on this book, who paddled the entire length of the river. And I joined him at the delta, where we walked 90 miles across the delta. And it's as dry and chapped and cracked as the Sonoran Desert surrounding it. And it's amazing because it basically is just testimony to, you know, what happens when you have a limited resource and you ask too much of it. It disappears. And the river ran to the Sea of Cortez for 6 million years, and basically we've seen it stop in the last decade. And I think a lot of that can be fixed. You know, I'm hopeful that with better efficiencies in agriculture and how we think of water across the West, there's no real one bad boy on the river, one culprit. We're all users. And I think that's part of the problem, is we treat water a little bit casually, and we need, all of us in the West need to be a little more conscious of our water consumption.
You grew up on a ranch, and you learned very early about water and irrigation, and that was part of the impetus for your understanding and passion about the river.
Yeah, I guess in part I've been a water manager from a kid. I've been damming and diverting to a degree, putting water across our hay fields. I grew up in central Colorado, and we raised a small herd of cattle. And I think that probably led to this book and this project in part because I was curious as a boy of, you know, wonder where that irrigation water, once it returned to the creek, where it went, how long it would take actually to get to the sea. And doing this project, I've learned that currently it doesn't reach the sea. I think it can, and we need to get creative and be wise, courageous, bold about what we do, our water managers do, and I think I'm optimistic. I think a lot of them are aware of what we're dealing with.
Well, this is something that I think is very important to talk about, which is that there are water managers, part of government, in positions of power in all the Western states who actually get this. They get that there's climate change. They get it's happening very rapidly, more rapidly than anybody thought. And they're making plans.
I think they are. I think there's some leadership in the water world, the Western water arena, that are they're aware that, you know, we've had a 10-year drought and we had a spike in water with a big snowpack in the last year, but they're aware that there could be a much greater drought ahead of us, and they are talking in the context of dry reservoirs and climate change happening faster. So they know that we have a serious issue, and they know that they all on paper want to work together and want to avoid litigation. They all realize that litigation is not helpful in the long term.
Right.
And they want to do it locally and keep away from the federal government coming in and telling them this is how it's going to be.
So why is it important for rivers to run all the way to the sea?
Well, it's interesting because there are many people, and it's part of where we are today, that think that water in the river is water wasted. And I think as a whole, though, because this river supplies so much for recreation, from fishing to boating to birding, etc., that there is a consciousness of the river being something more than just a diversion for money and developments and whatnot. But also on another more fundamental level, I think it's important to reach the sea because the Colorado River Delta, was once one of the largest estuaries in North America. And estuaries create remarkable habitat for bird life and fisheries as well. So the ecology creates biodiversity, and ultimately biodiversity helps us. We depend on biodiversity for our own health as a species on this planet. So,
and that's always the conversation we have is it important because it helps us, and or is it important because these species have a right to live in the habitats they've been living in for much longer than we've even been a species?
Sure. Well, I think that the river, I mean, it has a right in its own. I'd like to make people aware that and get them to think of a river as its own entity, and that the river should have its, you know, a right to have a minimum flow to carry to the sea. But if you don't buy that, then I like to argue that there are a lot of species that depend on it, and we want to support them. But if you don't want to buy that, ultimately, all of this collectively works to benefit us with biodiversity. So,
we're talking to Pete McBride about the book, The Colorado River Flowing Through Conflict. So let's sort of go down the river together. What is the river like at its source?
So the river starts in Rocky Mountain National Park, which is Poudre Pass, about 12,000 feet up in the Rocky Mountains. And all the water, all the snow melt, or snow that becomes snow melt, that lands on the western side of Colorado and the western side of the Continental Divide, ultimately flows into the Colorado River Basin. So actually there is a starting point in Rocky Mountain National Park, but if you consider the basin of all these tributaries, the water is originating on all the western side of the Continental Divide.
Right.
So the snow peaks around where I live in Basalt, Colorado, near Aspen, all of that snow melt ends up in the Colorado River Basin. So as we move down southwest, it carries down through Colorado and it cuts its way through Utah, and we know a lot of the monuments, Canyonlands National Park and Arches, and it creates some of its largest rapids there in Cataract Canyon. And then it comes into Lake Powell, which is one of the first big reservoirs, and it's part of the upper basin. It's Lake Powell's used for water storage and how they manage the river.
What is Lake Powell like right now?
Lake Powell is it's definitely lower than it has been. It's come up a little bit recently, but there's a huge bathtub ring, is what they call it, this white line that we see now.
Right.
Shrouding the entire lake. And there's what's I find fascinating about Lake Powell is all the sediment that the river carries naturally. It you know, comes down through these big muddy rapids, and the saying is that the river used to be too thick to drink and too thin to plow. And it was all that, you know, Rocky Mountain sediment.
Right.
That all gets deposited in Lake Powell. So these mountains of silt that have formed throughout Lake Powell, and because all the water running below the dam, Glen Canyon Dam, it comes out crystal clear and cold, which has changed the ecology for the fish and whatnot. Well, moving downstream, though, below Glen Canyon Dam is actually Lee's Ferry, which is the divider. There's two basins, how they manage the water. And we go through the Grand Canyon, which everybody knows generally and loves and adores, and then it reaches Lake Mead, which is Hoover Dam. Once was the largest dam in the river, built in 1935, remarkable piece of engineering.
Indeed, and even that is running really low at this point.
Very low. It's barely at half full, even despite this big runoff here.
And the, of course, danger and fear is that if climate change is left to just take its course, there won't even be enough water to get energy out of the dam.
Yeah, exactly. Deadpool is what they call it, and you have it's too low to get any momentum out of the head, so our turbines don't work. But also just the storage, the reservoirs store 4 times of the annual flow of the river, and each reservoir, Lake Powell and Mead, are about a little over 50%. So we've cut way back in our bank account of water in the West.
Right.
And that's creating some of the concern, of course. And anyway, as you move south, the river becomes the border between Arizona and California. And then it reaches the Mexican border right about Yuma, Arizona, and actually becomes the U.S.-Mexican border. And there it meets its last dam on the river, the Morelos Dam. Mexico does get its supply of water, 1.5 million acre feet. But below that dam, the river kind of fizzles out into nothing. And having paddled into it, it's kind of like a Frappuccino pit, as I call it. It's full of who knows what, discharge from farms and plastic bottles and whatnot. And then suddenly the river stops. And you are a good probably 100 miles today from the Sea of Cortez. One point on that is, to give a little perspective, is that delta used to be 3,000 square miles. Now it's just as there's only 10% of it left, which we supply with a little bit of irrigation water that's too contaminated to put on our crops. But we used to run steamships down the Colorado River. If you wanted to go from Yuma, Arizona to, say, San Francisco in the early 1900s, you would get on a steamship because there was no train back then. You'd actually head south down the Colorado River to the Sea of Cortez, get on a cargo ship, and go around Baja California.
Oh, my goodness.
So just in 100 years, we've seen it go from this vast lake that was as far as the eye could see to nothing.
There's a lot of areas along the river that are protected, most especially in Arizona, the Grand Canyon, and so on. To what extent does that protection really help the river, given that there's so much of the rest of it that's not protected?
The national parks, to my knowledge, don't have a relationship with the flow of the river. They protect the area from development. What does protect the river and the flow is allocations downstream.
Right.
So guaranteeing that California gets its water is actually, in part, protects the river flowing, at least to the straw, as I like to call them, that's going to head out to California. Now, in Mexico, they don't have a law to protect inflow stream rights in the river. They say that there is some language to protect some, but it's not nearly as concrete as we have in the U.S. So I have heard people say that it's Mexico's fault that the delta's dry, but I don't think that's fair because I don't think it should be Mexico's burden to supply the delta. I think we should all have some responsibility to keep the delta alive because it's a treasure, you know, for not just Mexico, but I think North America.
We're talking to Pete McBride about the book, The Colorado River Flowing Through Conflict. Now, pollution is, of course, also an issue. What are some of the sources of pollution that feed into the river historically and now?
Well, the main problem is that the river gets reused so many times. By the time it reaches the U.S.-Mexican border, it's been used 8 times. And what happens each time it goes through a field is it's picking up fertilizer and salt. So it's really salt's the big problem. We actually have a desalinization plant in Yuma that we built to clean up the water for Mexico. And we recently ran it on a test period for about a year. It's actually built in the 80s, but it's so expensive to operate that we haven't been using it. And so salt is really the big issue. With less water, you get higher salt. And you also get a lot of these fertilizers that carry into it. So that's really the big issue. And I think that's been a problem and will continue to be a problem. There is other issues, isolated issues that play a role in the river throughout it from uranium. There's a uranium tailings pile next to Moab, Utah, and they're reclaiming it, moving it right now, but it's one of the spots you see on the river where tamarisk is very dead. Tamarisk is a invasive species that we introduced. It's very loves water. Can suck up about 200 gallons a day. Hard to kill, hard to manage. It's taken over much of the river. And below that uranium tailings pile, you can see that it's pretty much knocked out. We actually have introduced a tamarisk beetle that seems to be effective. Of course, we don't know the unintended consequences.
Oh, Lord. I mean, the unintended consequences of releasing insects from other ecosystems.
Yeah.
And it almost never works out.
Yeah, so who knows what'll happen there. So far, it's been 3 years, and they think it's working. And
really?
Yeah. People are optimistic, but who knows? They introduced tamarisk for erosion control in the 40s.
Right.
Look where we are with that one.
Let's talk about the process of actually making this book, making the photographs. You worked with your co-author, Jonathan Waterman, to create this book. I find it fascinating to look at a book where the pictures are not only beautiful, but they tell a story. That's a really important part of it.
Yeah, for me, I was trying to create awareness with this, and I was trying to make people look and pause and think about the issue. So I needed a different platform to do that, because we've seen hundreds, thousands of pictures of river runners and rafters and river scenes. So most of the book is actually aerial photographs.
Right.
I actually hired my father, who's a bush pilot, and he's a very good pilot. So I hired him for the upper part of the river, which was fun. I got to boss my old man around a bit, so to speak. But we were actually a good team. And I think that perspective enables us to look at something, gives us human perspective, sees where we've been, where we haven't been, how we've changed the landscape, but also it gives us perspective on the river as a whole river, not just our neighborhood section and what it provides for us, but this connective entity that really connects the whole West.
And you have some of the manifestations of climate change and the various changes we've been talking about, including some of these dead forests in Colorado and so on.
Sure. So there's issues throughout the whole basin, from beetle kill to how we use the water, and from mining to agriculture. Over 70% of the river goes towards agriculture, so there's quite a bit of focus on that as well. And we need agriculture, of course, if we want to eat healthy and eat generally locally.
And eat.
Yeah, we don't want to import all our food from overseas, so that is important. You know, we can't just say, well, let's take all the water from ag. But we can find better efficiencies in ag. A lot of the municipalities, the cities, have they've started to use less and less water. Of course, the cities are what is generally growing. We don't have this huge wave of people signing up to be farmers and trying new farming operations.
Right. Cities are growing, but still agriculture uses the vast majority of the water. Are there, really possibilities for very large reductions in water use through different kinds of irrigation?
Sure. There's drip irrigation, and I was actually just talking to a water authority and some down in Yuma, Arizona, and they actually put in drip feeds in the field, and these tractors have GPS systems so their plows won't hit the drips. And the advantage there is that you don't have to do flood irrigation. Flood irrigation, you need this giant head of water to get all the way across. So it has a little bit of waste built into it.
Right.
But with drip is better. Also, my family, we went to gravity-fed sprinkler systems. We have no motors to run the sprinklers. And sprinklers in general, if you're not, if you can get away from using a pump to run them, they're energy efficient and you use less water because you're sprinkling equally. So we use about 60% of what we used to use. Now the challenge is we have these antiquated laws like use it or lose it with your water rights. So whether you have savings in your usings or not, if you don't use your whole allocation, you potentially lose it. So we need to update things like that.
Right, and which is not easy politically.
No. And the one thing I try to make in this book, I try to simplify and show the big picture, but the reality is it's a very complex issue, and it's going to involve a lot of different players and a lot of bright minds, and hopefully all of us water users to be more conscientious about everything we do.
The book is called The Colorado River Flowing Through Conflict. Pete McBride is a photographer in this book. Now, are you, you're giving presentations and not only making the book available to people, but really going around and talking about it and about this, all your work.
Yeah, I've been tromping around the West and beyond, trying to not just, you know, to push a book, really just to push a message that we have a spectacular, we have one of the world's greatest rivers in our backyard, and it's imperiled. And we're facing, as trends continue, which everyone says they're going to, it's only going to get more dire. So we're facing a situation that is, you know, somewhat troubling. I'm optimistic that we just need to help create awareness, and if we have the engineering capabilities to produce all these remarkable diversion projects and dams like Hoover Dam, which has enough concrete in it, they say, to build a highway from Boston to Seattle.
Right.
Amazing. If we can do that, I think we can, if we put our minds to it, we can restore the river and, you know, fulfill our needs as humans, but also sustain water for the critters that need it as well.
Pete McBride, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Dr. Trevor Hawkins. He's founder and medical director of the Southwest Care Center. And Stella Reed is with us. She is the director of community outreach there. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Thank you.
So our subject today is hepatitis, and specifically hepatitis C. Let's just start with hepatitis. What is that?
Well, hepatitis actually means inflammation of the liver. So hepatitis can be caused by lots of different things. And what we're really talking about today is a virus called the hepatitis C virus, which causes inflammation of the liver. And it's in fact has become the leading cause of liver transplantation in the United States. It's a virus that was not identified really till the early 90s, and so the blood supply was not screened for hepatitis C until 1992. So really the bulk of infections occurred in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in this country, and actually reached a peak in the mid-80s. It's transmitted by blood products, so it's transmitted by blood transfusions or by sharing needles.
Is it also sexually transmitted?
It can be. It's not very efficiently sexually transmitted in the way hepatitis B is, or HIV. But it can be sexually transmitted. And certainly there have been recently some notable outbreaks amongst young gay men, and sometimes not so young gay men, in sort of cohorts of sexual partners who are transmitting the virus backs and forwards. So you certainly can get it sexually, but not very easily.
How are most people actually getting it? There's a lot of people who have hepatitis C.
Yeah, there are. Actually, the incidence, which is the number of new cases, is declining. The bulk of people who got it earlier on, as I say, prior to the blood screening, and before, I think, people were aware of the dangers of sharing needles. Now we have a needle exchange program in New Mexico, and in lots of other places in the United States. I think people are a little bit more careful, although clearly people who actively inject drugs and share their works are still getting infected. And so it's not that there aren't any new infections. There are. There's thousands of new infections every year. But the bulk of people who are infected got infected earlier on. It's a long, slow disease in the sense that it takes up to 20 years before you actually develop cirrhosis or liver failure. And so a lot of people who got the disease back in the day are now developing liver disease.
So in the time before you develop, for example, cirrhosis of the liver, are there symptoms?
Very often not, no. When you first get infected, you may be symptomatic. You may have an acute hepatitis. Where you get jaundiced and fever and so on. And actually, interestingly enough, a proportion of people control the virus themselves and don't go on to be chronically infected. In the general population, it's sort of 15 to 20% of people actually control the virus and don't go on to become chronically infected. And those people who have an acute illness actually do better. They're more likely to control the virus.
Interesting. So they develop the proper antibodies.
Exactly. And clear it. But 80% of people go on to become chronically infected. By the way, of interesting, it's the reverse in hepatitis B. In hepatitis B, majority of people clear it. Only about 20-25% of people go on to become chronic carriers.
Has it been studied what the differences are between the people who clear it and those who don't?
That's a great question, and the answer is yes. People have looked at that. So the predictors of clearing include being younger, having an acute reaction, what else? Gosh, I'm trying to think of, are there any other? Those are the two that come to my mind. Clearly being co-infected with another virus, such as HIV, decreases your chance of clearing.
Right.
So
basically having a highly reactive immune system,
right,
is helpful.
It's helpful. So if you, being healthy clearly is a good thing.
Right. So how many people in the U.S. have this disease?
Well, actually, it's probably underestimated, but probably the true figure is about 5 million.
That's a lot of people.
Now, in case people call and say, wait a minute, I read that there was 3 to 4 million, something like that. We think that the study that's most quoted actually underreported because they didn't look at incarceration. I mean, the rate of hep C amongst incarcerated inmates is huge.
So why is that?
Well, because there's a lot of injection drug use.
Inside of prisons.
And prior to prisons.
And so, I mean, it's, I suppose, daunting or horrifying that the prison population of the United States is so significant that it would alter the results of a study on the prevalence of a disease.
Well, we incarcerate more people than anyone else in the world, I think, and and a huge proportion of young black men end up in prison, often for drug offenses, which to my mind is absurd, and should be in rehab, not prison.
We're talking to Dr. Trevor Hawkins about hepatitis C. Now, would you call this disease an epidemic?
Well, yes and no. I wouldn't call it an epidemic because it's actually, as I say, the incidence of new cases is declining. It's still happening, but it's declining. So it isn't really meet the definition of an epidemic. It was probably epidemic in the mid-80s. What is sort of epidemic, if you like, although it's probably a bad use of the word technically, is the fact that now those people who got infected in the early days are now getting sick with liver disease.
And that's simply because they're getting older and more vulnerable?
They're getting older and more vulnerable. They've had the infection for a long time, and it slowly affects the liver through inflammation and fibrosis.
The virus, what on a micro level is it actually doing? How does it hurt the liver?
Well, it causes an actual inflammation in the... It's interesting, of course, that this virus is particularly attracted to the liver cell, as opposed to, say, HIV, which infects multiple different kinds of cells. Now, there are extra hepatic or outside the liver manifestations of hepatitis C, such as some specific skin diseases and so on associated with hepatitis C. But predominantly, the virus enters into the liver cell and replicates, infects liver cells, causes them to become slowly inflamed. And after a while, that inflammation starts to lead to fibrosis. So the liver becomes increasingly stiff. And you can actually measure liver stiffness. And after a while, as the fibrosis increases, areas of fibrosis start to connect with one another, and you get a thing called bridging fibrosis. And eventually the whole liver becomes fibrotic, and that's when we call it cirrhosis. And that then the liver starts to fail.
Because that fibrous liver tissue can't do livers do.
It's non-functional, yeah.
Can the fibrosis be reversed?
Actually, it can, to some extent, yes. So if you look at studies of liver fibrosis in people who are successfully treated for hepatitis C, you can see improvement in that fibrosis. So absolutely.
How is hepatitis C treated?
Up to now, it's been treated with two drugs. One's called pegylated interferon, which is an injection every week under the skin. And the other drug is called ribavirin, which is approximately five or six pills a day. And the success rate is about 40% with those two drugs. So very good.
Yeah.
If you're co-infected with HIV, success rate drops to about 20%. Now, that's in the commonest genotype. The genotype is, if you like, what strain of the virus do you have? By far the commonest in the United States is genotype 1, 1A or 1D. That constitutes about 75% of all hepatitis C in the United States and, unfortunately, is the most difficult to treat. Success rates in genotypes 2 and 3 is more like 80%.
Using those same drugs.
Yeah, but unfortunately, that's a much rarer genotype.
Right.
Now, I did want to say that picture has changed recently, very recently. Two new drugs were approved this year for the treatment of hepatitis C, and they're really already changing the face of treatment.
What are they, and how are they different?
They're different because they directly kill the virus. So they're what we call directly acting antivirals. Their names are telaprevir and bisoprevir, and they're protease inhibitors. Protease is an enzyme, if you like, in the produced by the virus that cuts up large pieces of virus into small virions and allows them to escape and infect other cells.
Uh-huh.
It directly inhibits that enzyme.
The other drugs that had the 40% success rate, they didn't work through killing the virus. They had another effect.
Mm. After all this time, it's fair to say we don't exactly know how they work.
Really?
Yeah. Now, we have an idea. And they work predominantly by encouraging the liver cell's own immune system to fight the virus. Now, they do have some action on the virus itself. So there are three phases of response. The first is killing the virus. Second is the immune response. And the third is another immune response. So there's two phases of the immune response. And those drugs worked mostly on encouraging the immune response. The newer drugs work mostly, in fact, almost entirely in a way, by actually killing the virus.
Now, these drugs, the new ones, have they become the drug of choice all over the country? Are they still kind of being introduced here and there?
They're certainly the drugs of choice now. So triple therapy is, with all three drugs, is now the standard of care.
Uh-huh.
But there are some barriers to their widespread use, one of which is cost. They're very expensive.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Are they manufactured by a drug company and have patents and they're
exactly.
just getting every dollar they can out of them kind of thing?
Exactly. And one of the problems here is that a lot of new drugs for hepatitis C coming down the pipe. These are the first two. In a few years, they will probably be overshadowed by better tolerated drugs. And so the companies really have a few years to recap their costs and make a profit.
Right.
And that's one of the reasons why they're so expensive.
And that cost gets borne by basically insurance, and our insurance premiums are high because of that.
Exactly. I mean, that's a whole, discussion on is there a better way to make drugs than the for-profit system we have now? And it's hard to think of one, quite honestly. And the most profitable market for pharmaceuticals is the United States of America.
Right.
And yet 80% of all new drugs are made here. So in a way, it looks like profit is a great motive for people making new drugs.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there must be some kind of hybrid system of
exactly.
profit and the
yeah.
public good
yeah.
so that more people can get treated. I mean, I imagine that people who don't have insurance, and that's still millions and millions of Americans, are not able to get treated for hepatitis C with these new drugs.
No, that's exactly right. There really is no system to cover people, and nobody could possibly afford to be treated. I mean,
right.
the cost of just one of these new drugs, the cost of the treatment is $48,000.
Per year?
That's for 12 weeks of treatment.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's not including the pegylated interferon ribavirin, which are also very expensive. So we're talking about a total treatment cost over a year of perhaps as much as $80,000 or $90,000.
How long does it take for the treatment to be effective, and then you stop doing it.
Well, here's a key point about this. Hepatitis C is curable. It's very different than hepatitis B and HIV, which are not curable. There's a fundamental difference in the viruses. They're all RNA viruses. They're made out of that RNA genetic material.
Right.
But HIV and hepatitis B make a DNA copy of themselves, which then splices or heads into your own nucleus. And in the case of HIV, actually splices into your own DNA, becomes part of your own DNA. It makes it very difficult to dig it out.
Right.
Hepatitis C doesn't do that. It only makes an RNA copy of itself. So it goes RNA, RNA, RNA.
Right.
And so it stays outside the nucleus and is curable.
Very interesting. Yeah, I guess our immune system doesn't have a way to deal with something that goes into our own DNA.
That's right. And the other thing about it is these viruses are actually disable the cell's innate immune system. The immune system normally would be able to control those. These viruses are successful in a sort of evolutionary way because they do disable the cellular machinery that normally controls them. So interestingly enough, when you kill the virus, and these new drugs kill it very rapidly indeed, you also allow the cell's innate immune system to turn back on because you're killing the virus, which is disabling the machinery. So it has a double effect in a way. So it is curable. Now, you asked how long it takes for the treatment. The traditional treatment, up till very recently with pegylated interferon ribavirin, was 48-week treatment, and as I said, 40% success rate. By the way, there's a lot of toxicity with this treatment as well.
So a lot of side effects.
A lot of side effects.
Like what?
Depression, flu-like syndrome, a pancytopenia, which means you can become anemic. Your red cells can go down, your white cells can go down, your platelets can go down. It's very tough to take. And now, of course, we're adding a third drug into that, so it's even more toxic. Rash is common. The good news with the new drugs is that it's possible that treatment duration can be significantly shorter. So if you get to being undetectable by 4 weeks and you're still undetectable by 12 weeks, currently you can stop treatment at 24 weeks, i.e. 6 months, instead of going on for 12 months.
Right. I mean, if the infection rate is going down, but there's still millions and millions of people who have it, this is a significant, what would you call it, line item on the nation's healthcare budget.
Huge. Because, as I said earlier, it is now the leading cause of liver transplantation. To take care of someone in end-stage liver disease is very expensive indeed. All kinds of things start to go wrong with the body, and it takes a lot to keep someone alive for those last few years. Also, there's not enough livers to go around.
Right.
So not enough livers to be able to transplant everybody. And, of course, those new livers get reinfected again.
Because the
virus hasn't gone away.
Is all over the body.
So the good news is not only are the new treatments that we have right now give you an 80% success rate, there are many more new drugs coming down the pipe.
Is there a vaccine or work on a vaccine?
There is no vaccine for hepatitis C. And one of the reasons there isn't, we have vaccines for hepatitis A, which is the infectious hepatitis you get from food and water, hepatitis B, which is the virus you get from mostly sexually transmitted, but also through blood products. We've been able to grow those viruses in cell culture for a very long time. What's held up the hepatitis C vaccine development is that we've not been able to grow it in cell culture. It was very, very difficult to grow until just a few years ago, when originally the first successful cell culture was in Japan.
Interesting. So there are vaccines for the other two. Are they, now that they've been able to start growing this virus in a cell culture, working on a vaccine?
People are looking at that, yeah.
Yeah. There's always questions about vaccinations, like who should get vaccinated and for what?
Right.
Should everybody, like let's say there were vaccines for hepatitis A, B, and C. Do you think every person in the United States should get them?
Well, I think there's a lot of questions about the use of a hepatitis C vaccine. One, as I said, the incidence of new infections is declining. Two, it's curable.
Right.
And three, in maybe 5 to 10 years, it may be curable by a simple one tablet a day.
Right.
And so there's not going to be the same impetus to develop that. Now, hepatitis A is a worldwide disease you get from food and water. That's the classic infectious hepatitis. And yeah, anyone who's going into an endemic area should get hepatitis A vaccine. It's extremely effective. It's extremely safe. Hepatitis B, you know, certainly all healthcare workers are vaccinated against hepatitis B in case they get struck by a needle or any other exposed to blood products that might contain it. So all of us get hepatitis B vaccine. There was certainly a recommendation that everyone should get hepatitis B, and that's, you know, still somewhat controversial.
Is hepatitis C a big issue in what, every developed country, every country of the world?
Yes. It's even more prevalent in the developing world than it is in the developed world, but it's global.
And why is that? I mean, everybody's using needles improperly?
Injection drug use is the single largest a source of hepatitis C. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And remember, injection drug use in Asia, in the previous Soviet Union, in Africa, is extremely widespread.
So, for example, in places where there's a lot of AIDS, like parts of Africa, and there's at least some of that is being spread through through needles, do you see a corresponding kind of overlapping graph of hepatitis C?
Yeah, you do. And hepatitis C is, as I say, it's common absolutely everywhere. And it's five times more common than HIV in the United States.
The CDC, I think I read on one of your sheets or somewhere, is finally taking making a plan that covers the nation. What are they doing, and what do you think is necessary for public health people to do on a large scale?
Well, I think we need to identify everyone who has hepatitis C. So testing is the core issue. It is with HIV too. It's estimated that right now, of the 5 million people who probably have hepatitis C in the United States, 75% of them don't know they have it.
Right.
And so
that should become part of a routine when you go to your annual checkup and they do blood work and things like that. They should be screened for that.
Absolutely, and certainly if you've ever had any exposure. And sometimes people are reluctant to talk about it. You know, they tried an injection drug back when they were a college or a kid, and there's a shame base about it.
Right.
So people are often unwilling to talk about it. There's actually stigma around hepatitis C. When we started treating hepatitis C patients at Southwest Care, I was actually surprised that people commented how at home they felt. They didn't feel any judgment, and I hadn't realized that there was stigma around this disease, and there is.
Now, let's talk about New Mexico. New Mexico has an extraordinarily high rate of liver disease. What's going on?
An extraordinarily high rate of hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely true. And why? Because there's a lot of injection drug use, both now and in the past. And so, high rates of hepatitis C and very few people know they have it until they get sick.
Stella Reed has been sitting quietly, but there's a very important and interesting event going on Wednesday, the 5th of October. What's happening?
Mm-hmm. That's our town hall. It's going to be out at Buffalo Thunder, like you said, on Wednesday, October 5th. At 7 o'clock in the evening, there'll be light refreshments served, and it's open to the public. It'll be an educational and informational event. Trevor will talk, and then we'll have a panel from Southwest Care Center talking about the plan that we have for care for people living with hepatitis C in New Mexico.
And who is invited to come, and who are you hoping will come?
We're hoping that everyone comes. The general public is invited. Anyone who thinks that they may have put themselves at risk for hepatitis C, anyone who has concerns about a family member. I think one of the most important things that Trevor said is that effective treatment is available, so folks need to be aware of that. Eventually, we're going to be doing screening, identifying people who have this. There's a new rapid test for hepatitis C, the same similar that we've been using for HIV. It's a 20-minute test. You can get your results in 20 minutes. And then we'll be doing education and prevention and linkage to care for folks that are living with hepatitis C in New Mexico.
Now, let's say somebody is living with hepatitis C and they don't have health insurance. They could inform themselves from here to the end of time, but they're not going to be able to get the treatment. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot people can do. I'll definitely come back to your question. There's a lot people can do. You know, they can stop drinking alcohol. They can make sure they don't accidentally transmit the virus to someone else through sharing razors or those kinds of things. We can teach people how to take good care of their livers. So there are lots of things people can do. The next thing to do, if people don't have insurance, you're absolutely right, there's no funding to support this, is to figure out how to for that person to get insurance. And now, you know, clearly if the insurance company knows you have hepatitis C, they will simply exclude you.
Right.
Now, that may change with the Affordable Health Care Act. It is intended that no one should be excluded because they have a disease. And so we'll see what happens in 2014 when that act is so-called Obamacare, but the Affordable Health Care Act is implemented.
And are there... this is something I should know about that legislation, but... If they can't exclude you for an existing medical condition, can they charge you 100 times as much as they charge the next person?
Well, that's in theory, no, they should not charge egregious amounts, but we'll have to see how this all plays out.
Right.
That is certainly a concern. Now, there is, for instance, no prior exclusion for federally funded healthcare such as Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
So people may be eligible for those. There is in New Mexico a high-risk pool called the medical insurance pool for people who are otherwise uninsurable.
And if people, let's say everybody who was uninsured with hepatitis C entered that pool, it would be a serious additional tax burden on the state.
Depending how many people chose to do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Not everybody is going to be eligible for treatment. And everyone's going to want to be treated.
Right.
There are all kinds of algorithms where we'll make those judgments and advise people, no, you probably should wait or not wait. A lot of people already have insurance. Southwest Care Center, doing a lot of clinical trials in hepatitis C.
Uh-huh.
And so one way for uninsured patients to get treated is to enroll in a clinical trial.
Right. And, of course, that drug may or may not be effective.
That's true.
Dr. Trevor Hawkins is the founder and medical director of Southwest Care Center. Stella Reed is the director of community outreach. And once again, the town hall is on Wednesday, the 5th of October at Buffalo Thunder. Anything else you'd like people to know?
Well, I think, you know, we really want to encourage people to get tested if they've ever been exposed to a needle or shared a needle in the past, had a blood transfusion prior to 1992, been in a close, intimate relationship with someone who has Hep C or may have Hep C. Get tested. I think that's the message we want. Get tested, know your status, and then you know, consult with us or with the folks at Northern New Mexico Gastroenterology or other experts in the area who can advise you on the best way to proceed. And I think a great way to learn about how you might proceed is to come to our town hall.
The website for Southwest Care Center is www.southwestcare, all spelled out, .org. So southwestcare.org.
And they're based right here in Santa Fe.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I think that the education and prevention component of this is as important as the treatment. Like Trevor said, not everybody's going to be eligible right away for treatment, and there are a number of things that you can do to improve your health, even prior to taking the medications.
Stella Reed and Trevor Hawkins, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.